not adjust your radio frequency. This is not a test. This is the Artist First Network.
Cool. Welcome to another broadcast of Bigfoot Central. That's in every time zone in both hemispheres, everyone. This is the longest running Bigfoot show on the planet, and we're glad to have everyone with us. You can send your questions and comments to dj@artistfirst.com, and let's turn things over to our co-host Don Monroe and MK Davis. Gentlemen, take it away.
Good evening.
Hey guys,
hello
out there. Yeah.
Don, how are you?
Well, I just come off the mountain. I've been up there chasing wolves, but we can't shoot them up here because it's against the law. But they've been chasing an elk herd pretty bad, and we're kind of keeping track of what they're doing. They're chasing the elk, and it's kind of bad because they lose their body fat, and a lot of them die by spring, and also there's a lot of them gestation. They're holding their young, and there's going to be a lot of boarded animals this year. We're a little concerned about it. Of course, the laws have the, against the wolves being shot, and these wolves are imported, so we're a little concerned about this.
Yeah, well, what do you think is causing that kind of behavior? Is that unusual?
Well, I can't say for everybody's opinion what I'm here to say, but they're acting unusual. The wolves are acting unusual up here, a little more carnivorous than normal. And they seem like they're wealthy. Our winters no snow much this year. It's been an unusual year. And the wolves, of course, can run full gallop rather than pounding in the snow, you know, leaping here to there. Elk the same way. So they're running too much, and we're concerned. It's only February. And if you run antelope or deer or elk too long, they won't ever make it to spring. A lot of them will just perish because of the body fat. It's not a true fat like the cattle we know, like beef and so on. And it's tallow, and it runs off these animals, and it's concerning me a lot. We have about 1,500 elk in this vicinity, and there are different herds, but they're all combined, sort of like,
yeah.
And then they get separated and chased in all directions, you know what I mean?
Bigfoot is iconic. Bigfoot is a representation of wildness.
What I want to say here about that, you know, wherever you find the bigger animals, the higher animals, you'll find the wild hominoid is usually represented, and I think this is a pretty round the world thing. And in longitude and latitude and elevation, I find it very similar in Europe and Asia and to Montana, Idaho, and the adjacent states. It's interesting about that right there, that concept. Why don't you go ahead and figure out what you're saying next about this show? But I'm looking forward to it. I can't see a thing you got posted, but I'm anxious to hear what you got.
Yeah, I was just going to say that I know you're familiar with some of these photos that you've seen them when you were here. Now, if the listeners will go to the Artist First homepage, and click on the Bigfoot Central button and go to the Bigfoot Central homepage. There they'll find under the flashing sign, they'll see that there is a button there for the February show photos. Click here. All right, click on that, and then you'll see the very first photo, and this is the one I was referring to. Don, you remember the two guys in the desert? One of them had the tall head, the cranium had been bound and made to be elongated, and he had the wrappings and stuff on the feet.
I sure do. In fact, it's conducive to some of the things I've discovered somewhat, and been laughed off the planet for it, you know, even bringing it up. But here we are 10 years later, and we're getting efforts like this. Those pictures were taken back in the 1870-something, I think, four.
I believe it's during the John Wesley Powell expeditions sponsored by the Smithsonian. And our good friend, Alias Herlishka.
Yeah, right.
The anthropologist who was a collector of bones. I call him the bone collector. I hope he didn't collect these two guys' bones. They looked like they were having a rough enough time as it was. One with the shaped cranium is no doubt somebody of importance in his among his people. The other guy, he doesn't have his head shaped, but what's kind of unusual about these guys are that they their appearance. They have full beards, which was said to be not possible among Native Americans.
That anomaly alone is very outstanding. You know, there are no bearded Native Americans, particularly even today, to think of it with a large extent. And that elongated skull is conducive to South American discoveries and also going into Egyptology and so on. But it has some ramifications of things that we can't cover tonight in the show. It's too short. But I want to bring on one point here real quickly here, if I just inject this. During that time and previous to it, about 1849 to 50 and 60 and up in that time frame, Captain Fremont was exploring the West, and also people like Captain Walker and Jedediah Smith and so on. And there was mentions in those early discourses, if you want to dig them up and read them, of some of these unusual Indians they found that were not conducive to the tribes that they normally knew. And I can't go into all that detail now, but it's in there, and it's these Indians also sitting there, as MK can point out, have a recurve bow. Recurve bows are not ordinarily seen in any museum. And these are very That's much right. like the ones that Ishii was had in his keep.
And I, if you notice on the on the right there, the guy's got a bunch of arrows in his left hand, and those arrows do not have arrowheads on them. The reason why is because they are composite shafts. In other words, they have a pouch that they carry with a short shaft, and the arrowhead is mounted to that short shaft. And they slide that short shaft into that bigger arrow. It's made to slide in there, and that
like
way,
a reed.
They,
a reed forward.
Right,
that can
when they
that
shoot
much.
An animal, when they shoot an animal, they recover their arrow. It comes out.
If you go into arrow recovery, you'll find out. If you go into one, the best museum I've seen this displayed ever saw in my life, and in my recent times, is down in Deming, New Mexico. They got an excellent museum there that shows the arrows down there of that type. And the reed type attached to a willow piece or whatever. And I was shown one years ago how to make arrows by the Paiutes in their area, but it was a little different but similar. And MK is correct. They only had a short range, really. The bows didn't shoot like our bows today do. They have 45 pounds of max, probably on power, between 30 and 50 pounds max. That's very much, maybe more than that, less than that, I mean. So they didn't have a lot of range.
Yeah, but you know, what strikes me as being kind of unusual about these guys, now, the Smithsonians thought they were so unusual and so different that they did not publish these pictures for many, many years. And the reason why is because it did not fit what was then the known, the accepted framework of Native Americans and the populating of the Americas. They were different. They had the beards and all. So they just
well, it's amazing they even existed at all because the cameras in those days were very nil. Very few cameras existed.
Well, they had the very latest that was available to them. The cameraman was a world famous photographer, John Hiller, who took these pictures.
You might tell them where you can find them at. Okay, what book is in?
You can find them in a it was once a pretty popular book, but it's been quite a few years since it was published. But it's Emory Strong's Stone Age in the Great Basin, and there's quite a few other images as well as a lot of information about what was going on in those days. But if you take a look at this guy's feet on the left there, you see how bound up he's not wearing moccasins. He simply has taken strips, and I'm not sure whether they're leather or some kind of textile, but he's bound his feet up in strips, first one way, then another, to the point where they completely enclose the foot, up the leg, up to the thigh. And it's hard to see how if it goes over all the way around, to up the back some. But
it's almost done like you would see in a hospital, almost when they wrap the wound, almost the same way.
Yeah, like mummy-like, mm-hmm. So he's protecting his feet that way. That's a very primitive way of doing it. Moccasins would be more protection, wouldn't you think, Don?
Yeah, and you'll get to it later on in the cast pictures, but I don't know what you're showing. But anyway, I can say this. Ten years ago, I was laughed off the block for even suggesting such a thing. But now we're starting to have people say, Well, anyway, the thing is, I've got casts that show wrapping in the hand areas, and also where they're in crawling in lava tubes and rough lava with damaged fingers and so on, broken appendages. And it's, no one believes it. I don't show the world yet. I will have to do it someday if I don't get that far. But I have a lot of, in my collection, quite a few things that are really unusual. And they're not conducive to the general prototype Bigfoot cast, so nobody wants to see these. You know, they've already decided what's possible to allow in the Bigfoot community, what they will allow to be the unusual and the unknown. So it's hard to break into this thing with anybody academically to come in there and say, hey, take a look at this, you know.
Yeah, you notice how lean these guys are. I mean, they're muscular and lean, and I mean, they are truly living, you know, subsisting off what they can kill and catch. And they're on the move all the time. So can you discuss
that recurve bow a little more, the bow and arrow itself? It's really important.
A recurve bow like that is sophisticated to make, and it's typically not, you don't see a recurve. Ishii had a recurve, and they were very puzzled by that. They said that it was something that smacked of Asia and the Mongolians.
That's true.
I think it's unfortunate that we don't know our own history as well as we should, but we have the habit, and I hope it doesn't, you know, always be our habit of extinguishing peoples and extinguishing cultures without even a thought about learning anything about them.
You recall MK down in Berkeley, California, Berkeley, went we were down there 3 years ago and went in the museum to see the Ishii display. Now we were both appalled at the surprise that they didn't have the recurve bow in the display. They had a regular, normal.
Right. All the stuff that Ishii had, about two-thirds of the stuff that he had originally displayed there had been
removed. And the American people will never know, and an average person would never know that, but, you know, the research on Ishii could be extended to a lot more than we know about him. And I do believe that there's been some...
Don, say Ishii's over there in the bushes hiding, and these guys were with Ishii and some more guys, and Ishii gets, you know, turns himself in, and they want to know if there's any others, and he says no. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah. Wouldn't tell all about your cover.
Right. These guys are living hand to mouth. You don't know if there's any left or not. They certainly could survive in the most primitive of conditions. You see that just looking. Now, if you scroll down some, let's just skip a little bit on down to past the petroglyphs, past the Idaho handprint, on down to Don's cave hand bandages. Now, Don, tell me about this. This is a cast that you took in an Idaho cave. Is that correct?
Yeah, you know, this is something new to the public, I'm sure, and I haven't showed anybody hardly because no one wants to see. They're important. I don't show them. But these casts I have absolutely indicate that somebody has helped somebody else to wrap their hands for different reasons, possibly for protection against the pumice, the rough stones in the lava tubes, or injury. We have lots of missing fingers on these casts, and it could be from frostbite or who knows what. They're not from traps. But I do find, and it's more than amazing, I didn't even want to plan to tell you this, but I will tell you. We have one cast that shows up to the elbow where they laid down prone in the cave, two of them side by side, and they laid their arm out there, and I've got a cast that shows the forearm up to the elbow, one bone's missing, where the bones cross. I'm not an anatomist to tell you what they call it, actually, part. But it crosses into the palm of the hand. One piece is missing, about 6 inches long. Well, it's been wrapped. Now, anything wraps up a bandage type on a hand or something like this on a leg, it's not a monkey. It's no giganto. And I'm telling you what, as long as 10 years ago, I tried to get this out, but, you know, I had a lot of flack on it. But anyway, this is something more than amazing, and I know that eyebrows are raising in the community out there right now who hears this. But I've got evidence of many things that are humanistic that are really absolutely incredible.
That thing is done
very professionally. And that's just the one with the picture he has there in 1874 or whatever it is.
Well, not so much anymore, Don. It's There's been quite a bit said as of late in the last couple of years about the
my deficit is I had no computer to work with. I mean, I'm out here in like in 2025 past.
Don, yeah. I have a computer, but I don't have casts from an Idaho cave. You have casts from an Idaho cave. You don't have.
More than one.
I think together we're doing pretty good tonight. If you look at that handprint really close, you see that it's wrapped and swathed in bandages, and individual fingers are wrapped. Now, you just scroll briefly back up to the guy at the top, and look how his foot is wrapped in similar strips. It's not unheard of to protect yourself in this way.
Now, you're talking about Russia and Siberia. That was done a lot. In fact, the Russian boots, even the military in current times, past times as far as 1918 and 20, back in that time, they still wrapped their feet. And they don't even use socks. They have a folded up of cloth on their toes and over their toes in a certain way. It's wrapped, actually, and it's not unusual.
But we're talking about a place. We're talking about a place in the United States where wolves are chasing elk.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is still a pretty wild place, and it's very expansive. And
where I live at, there's right now as we speak on the outback out here. There's not a soul up there. Maybe a lone trapper, maybe not. And this goes in for 100 square miles all the way to Salmon, Idaho, 150 miles more than that, down as far as the Labatubes, all the way down as far as Yellowstone Park. People don't, in the cities, of course, I'm not putting you down, they have no idea what wilderness is left in this country. And since the BLM and so on has locked up everybody out of it, it's getting wilder because there's no way of crossing the fences, and a lot of places are getting to be more and more the home of the wild man. He has more extensive room to move. I mean, it just is there.
Okay, so the possibilities are there. The technical aspect of getting a cast in a cave. Don, why are these casts so detailed?
Well, you know, they were fresh. I had that particular cast you're mentioning there. We went into one room he called the bedroom. Well, there are a lot of reasons for that. We had eight different beds in there dug in the sand, and this is a story conducive to General Fremont, Captain Fremont. But this cave has, I have some video footage of this and never been seen. I mean, you've seen part of it, taken by lay photographers, who it was too bad because sometimes they stopped and got a good picture, other times it's just hard to read it. I've got to get these deciphered and then edit it down where you can actually see what's going on. Where you stop, though, sometimes there's incredible pictures show up. And while those casts were taken, and I was in the cave, and there was four guys with me. We was looking for a sign, way digging for hares. We got over 100 hares that day, by the way. Anyway, so back in 2004, I said, don't go back in that corner. I feel there's a certain reason, not necessarily a danger, but potentially that, or somebody back there in that corner. I feel the vibrations of some, I just felt it, you know, you do this. And we didn't go back there for 45 minutes. When I went to that corner and approached it, we found where two had laid down prone. One of them take two hands and push over his head into the sand, and I got a double cast of two hands pushing up sand into a little mound. I think it's a female because the larger one next to it was the one that I'm talking about with the broken arm. And how to get around this in these caves is another subject, but I don't know how they get around this, but of course, if you study ninja efforts and so on, you can almost see that.
Hold it, Don. Look at the lean muscle on these guys. It's really not that hard to understand how they could get around in tight places.
No, it's not. You know,
these guys are carrying a frame that has no excess weight, and every bit of muscle they got is usable. I mean, it is tight. So
you'd analyze the Chinese acrobats and the ones from Asia who do these fantastic things. You see them on display. And you see the body tone that they have there, and it goes from childhood up to adulthood. A lot of our athletes start when they're 12 years old or 14 or 15. These guys start when they're 1 year old or babies. And the Sasquatch, call them that if you want to, the wild people out there, are trained from birth, I believe this, to be absolutely tough. I mean, they don't even leave a track if they can. They're not hiding themselves. They're just very cautious. They know they get discovered. One gets discovered, they're discovered, and then they're at the end of them.
they're so elusive because they're very intelligent, and they're so intelligent, they'll almost laugh at the efforts of humans to try to find them, humans as we know ourselves.
Well, you know, it's not to say that these guys are examples of Sasquatch, but they are examples of unusualness and variance within the human genome, within the human family.
You've got to realize we haven't referenced what a Sasquatch actually is ever yet.
No, we don't have a frame of reference. We have indicators and pointers, but we don't have an absolute frame of reference yet. We're hoping that this may be the year when a reference can be established genetically. And they were kind of just, waiting for some projects to get finished and some things to be done. And maybe perhaps this will happen. And I say maybe because anybody that's been in this business for a long time knows that sometimes things go slow and sometimes things don't happen. So we're hoping for the best, and you know, we're rooting for the good people who are investing their time and efforts and their money into genetic studies, that they actually, you know, get something concrete that we can use as a reference.
Nobody has ever claimed, I don't think, before this tonight, that they've had bandaged hands on or feet, either one on supposedly a wild man. And, you know, I'm not mentioning names, but I showed these cast, a couple of them, to some academics, the people involved who were pseudo whatever they were. Anyway, 2004, and I was actually hee-hawed it was the intermission of the Bigfoot community. And they said, Donnies are fantastic casts and unusual, and they're really something else, but they're too human to be possible. They're just too human-like to be Bigfoot. Well, Bigfoot to me is a wrong name. Harry Anderson's doesn't fly. All this stuff has been, you know, it's been put down in there like Mickey Mouse. I mean, we have possibly more than one entity out there that is possibly, could be qualified as what the so-called Sasquatch is, and it's a wild, fertile people. That's all it is. And it goes back to aeons of time. And there's a story for it. There's a big one. So, I don't know.
Sometimes a feral is kind of a word that's not very well defined. How feral are you talking about?
Feral am I, for goodness sake? I'm sociable, but I'm not what you call prototype of individual in this day and age. I know my kind died off 1,000 years ago.
Would you call these two guys in the picture, would you call them feral?
Well, not necessarily in their time frame in our community, but they'd be feral to the explorers.
Right, they'd be feral to the people that took the picture. They'd be feral to the...
They would, but not to their own community. And, you know, see, the bearded people like that, they had to come from some society other than just Native Americans as we know them. You look at the three movements that anthropologists and archaeologists claim they came from South America up and back and forth and so on, the main ones they had, and they're mainly, you know, hundreds of years apart. And you see the movements from Asia and Eurasia, Europe and Asia, and you start seeing all the people who come here and possibly mix together, you're going to have some tribes that were never even identified. And as you brought out a few months ago on a program back in the 1800s, about 1820 or 30, in that time they wiped off a lot of people who were not even known to have a name to them in different tribes and Native Americans. And these stories are out there, and there's some of them had blue and green eyes. And so what do we have in the West out here today? I mean, what's possible? A lot of red-headed people described a lot of times. Even in the Asiatic studies of the, back in the pre-times of the China Wall, they had the raiders from the north come down who were green-eyed and blue-eyed people with red hair. And who were they? And they don't know yet for sure what they were, you know, what kind of a mixture they were, who they were exactly. They knew part of them, but some were unidentified.
Well, now, Don, back to the casts from the caves, you know, we were talking about, you know, why they were so detailed. You said they were fresh.
Minutes old. I mean,
Go ahead.
What I've done in those early years, from 2001, 2, 3, 4, 5, until 6 and 7, I was adamant. I spent a lot of my time, money, and everybody. I had 50 people involved in this thing over 10 years, and they were never acquainted, most of them, more than just some of them were. And I had some magnificent explorers with me who were non-interested in being popular. They really, really the cowboy type.
and we found that a lot of things happened, and the freshness would be so fresh. You know Ken, you know Bear.
Right, right.
I had Bear and his partner, Gail, in a cave on New Year's Eve on 2004 on purpose. It was 40 below zero outside, and we were in this cave in the Zach and Norris cavern. And I told him, I said, if you feel anything in this cave tonight, this place, and you feel uncomfortable, any one of you, you know, we're all different, we'll leave, because I don't want to have you feel like you're, you know. So we went in there. I said, now I want to tell you something. That sounds incredibly off the wall, but I said, I know there's something in here tonight in this cave. It's too cold not to be, and also the vibrations, you get so you can kind of tell. It's kind of like reading a closet when someone's hiding in there. So I told him I felt the presence of something. We had four people with us, myself. Anyway, long story short, we got back in the cave and found a magnificent handprint. I cast it with 8-inch fingers. I mean, that's the one you're showing, I'm not sure. But,
The very bottom one in this list of photos says Don's Cave Hand 3 shows the long fingers compared to the size of the palm.
Okay, then I put on that cast, I said, now there's something in this cave. They all believed it by that time. They all turned all directions, like I told them to. We all faced every direction. And I said, now we'll be gone about 3.5 hours from this point and come back here. So I took hairspray, which I do, and I, like a cloud, I come down on top, so it kind of sets up on the cast area when I'm going to come back to it. So it kind of sets up, and the dirt don't stick to the plaster so much. So we come back in 3.5 hours, and lo and behold, like this is where I am writing the book right now. At that point in time, there was two handprints. One of them came back and put the same one came back and put the other hand right next to it. I cast them both. And this just put the hair on the back of your neck go straight up. I tell you what, everybody thought, wow. Well, this is how fresh they are. And I've got some prints in those casts I've taken. Being a novice in some respects, I still am. It's really experimentation to cast a proper cast, sometimes under adverse conditions of no light, little water, adverse conditions you can't even describe in blackness. And I've done it by flashlight, candlelight, and every way you can think of. I've been lucky a few times, got some pretty important casts. I took some of them down and sent them to Jimmy Chilcutt years ago, and he was amazed. And he told me there on the phone and also in a note that I mailed him to him about a dozen of them, and it was back in 2005, from memory, or 4, I forget. But he said, these are definitely unusual. He says, I've got to remind you, he said, I'm not an anatomist. I'm a fingerprint expert. Get me some fingerprints. Well, that's difficult because in sand, it's difficult to get fingerprints or anything else. But I got lucky sometimes in some real light cave dust that falls down over aeons of time and it stacks up 6 inches deep. And sometimes you're lucky in some of these caves to find a little patch of that. Well, I've been lucky enough to have a few handprints and that and footprints. They grope in the dark just like we do in the dark. They grope as they go. And so I find fingerprints, not prints, but the fingertips, my elbow marks, and so on. So all my casts aren't conducive to the typical prototype Bigfoot cast you see flattened out there everybody has. I haven't got quite that same thing. And so it's I got some of them that are similar, but mine in rough terrain where it's not conducive to the forest exactly. And I've taken very few casts in the forest areas, but I have done it. But they're not the same as I have here either because they're never damaged like this. And
well,
I took a lot of them down the swamps area at a different time.
The matrix in a cave, the dust, the substance
uh-huh.
in which the prints are made, is a unique substrate as far as casting. It's one of the few substrates that has the definition and has the fine particles so that you can actually get a print of dermal ridges, which is the swirl patterns. You know, on the palm and on the fingers, and it's what fingerprint experts, you know, actually look for when they try to match. It's the fingerprints themselves and the palm prints. So what we have here on these casts are intricately detailed handprints, and I understand you have some footprints as well. But let me ask you this about the very bottom picture that's got the long fingers. It seems like it's got a thumb of normal proportions and then three long fingers and then a digit. The little finger seems to have the be short again. Why?
That cast is very unusual. All of them are. Now, that one there, from I can't see the picture you're showing, but I know which one you mean. They're unusual in this way. If you lay your hand on that cast in your mind's eye, and you see the angle from your little finger back to your thumb, it's on a 45-degree angle nearly to get across the whole picture. But that one there shows the fingers going straight up from where you're pointing out, and the fingers are right along across one another like they're on a gun sight. You know, and to me, it's totally adverse to anything we have in our knowledge of our own anatomy on hands. Then the fingers being 8 inches long, the whole palm with involved is all of 12 inches. That's an incredible large person. And I found the first evidence that...
I'll stop here just a minute and ask you, because these fingers are so long, do you think it's possible that it might be just drug? The fingers might have just been dragged out?
Well, that's what some academics wanted to tell me way back. And I said, you know, how stupid can you be? If you drug your fingers, you'd drag your palm, wouldn't you? Well, I didn't drag the fingers and drag the palm because the palm shows the dermal ridges in it.
It would seem a little bit unusual for there to be continuous, skin impressions all the way up.
You couldn't drag your fingers. You cannot drag your fingers in a cast and then label like this, proportion-wise, right, correct, about dragging your palm. In this case, when you have the flexion creases and dermal ridges in the palm, shows a similar handprint to our own, whoever we are. It's very similar, and it's amazing. And yeah, they weren't dragged. In fact, I've got witnesses. Everything I say, and I know I sound like a... Anyway, everything I say, I've got pictures, photographs, witnesses, video footage. I've got everything imaginable to prove it. But the thing is, it don't seem to be conducive to what the academics or the lay...
That may be the case right now, but things change when the facts come in. And oftentimes the facts end up being something very different. These long fingers, you know, when I first look at these, I raised an eyebrow, but it's hard to commit to, your full belief in them without some kind of corroboration.
I got to tell you about this. In Tibet, they got them in pictures on pictographs. You've got them in Utah. You've got them in California. I've got some pictures from the last Tanya and I took 2 years ago down in New Mexico of six-fingered, long-gated fingers. These are not unusual to people who study the petroglyphs and petroglyphs around the country.
Well, that's what I was going to say. If the listeners just go to the very top, right under the two guys with the bows and arrows, you'll see petroglyphs in a Utah cave, long fingers, and you'll see examples of normal proportioned hands and then examples of hands with very long fingers as compared to the palm. You know, and when I first saw this picture, my mind went back to Don's cave casts. I think that when you dismiss something, you know, out of hand without giving it its due, sometimes it comes back and it bites you. You know, and it's a bad mistake to do that. And when you see here that these palm prints clearly are not drug out. They are an imprint of actual palms and fingers that have extraordinarily long fingers. And my mind also went back to the digits on the feet of the Yagans. You remember we had the show a while back?
Yeah, right, the long toes.
Mm-hmm. And the feet had... the very long toes. I mean, they were as long as fingers. So when someone tells you, well, this can't be or that can't be.
The Yagan, the Yamana, I've checked a lot of anatomy books. I went a lot of effort a while back to find out one picture existing in anatomy books about that. There's nothing to explain about that at all. And, you know, in consanguinity and Marfanism, in Marfan, when you're tall and extra tall and long and lean, which is not always the case of people, pretty unusual actually, but they get to be long, lean people, they still have proportions of 8 parts to their body. Well, these hands have to be something that's as large in proportion to the hands in overall. I begin to tell you one part of this whole story. It's important to me to get this out. When I first found evidence of what I've been finding all these years and still am finding, I didn't find any evidence before, but I went down into an area looking for petroglyphs. During December, in the wintertime, I was hunting rabbits. But I was also looking for Bigfoot efforts, I mean, a Bigfoot sign, if it's possible. That time in my life, I was still bamboozled by what this could be. And then I found where they dug down to water in hard pan sand in December in Idaho, in a stream bed. And it was more than amazing. I had pictures of the whole take. I dead reckoned tracked this creature, call it that, for a mile and a quarter. It was getting down towards sundown, and I found this cave that I call Zakonoris. And I'd walked by it 50 times, at least, in the last 10 years before that. Never seen it. But anyway, the thing is, these creatures are absolutely human. And when I tracked it out there, I'm a fair tracker. But the thing is that I'm not the best, but I'm one of those that can do it. So I found out they walked on sagebrush, they walked on anything was going to hide their foot track. Never known I was coming after them. I had no idea I was even on their trail. And they had no idea anybody ever found a sign of them, because I wasn't out there more than once in that area for a long time. So they do this out of habit. They don't do it just because I'm following them or somebody is.
Well, you know,
they do this out of...
Ishii said he did that too as well. That he hid in, he lived in a 12 square mile area in the middle of all around him there were settlements and people living, and he very conscious, it became a way of life with him that he would step, he would jump from rock to rock or either brush his tracks.
Absolutely.
Away.
Absolutely.
You know, and nobody ever knew he was there until someone stole his arrow-making kit that he had hung in a tree. And his arrow, he couldn't make arrowheads, and he nearly starved, and he came out and went into a slaughterhouse to try to get some food and got caught in there.
You see, all the references on computers and all the references on think tanks, the only things out there are flying. But never in my whole life have I seen a computer out in the woods or a think tank running around. And, you know, there's thing about this is you can look at a computer, find information. People do it. I even got one in my house. I didn't want one of them to tell you the truth. I haven't got time for it. But the thing is, it's not the last word. I mean, books are written to be rewritten. They're written to refer to for some reference to go on ahead and conquer the whole problem. And what the MK is explaining is true. I've taken the best people in my crew, the best ones who are the most mountain men type, and give them 5 minutes start and try to track them down and could not do it. In the springtime, when muddy water is out there, and muddy ground and so on, they walk on sagebrush, on cactus, where they want to step with boots. They can evade you so well. And I know where they're going, toward that tree over there. Still can't find them. You give a man a 45-minute start, and he can't 45-second start almost. You turn your back, and you almost can't find a good man in the woods, or even the sagebrush desert. So,
Yeah. I would be willing to bet that these two guys at the top up here disappeared shortly after their picture was taken.
Well, Fremont wrote, and I can tell you, this course is Fremont. You can read about him in 1849, probably that time frame, across the Nevada-Utah deserts. And he come across these Indians they called diggers. Well, that was a common term for a lot of different tribes. But they find these Indians just surprise them, and they'd run for it. And he said in his book, you can read about it. I mean, this is a paraphrase, but of course, but in a matter of seconds, maybe a minute and a half, less than that. Never saw them again. Couldn't find them. Couldn't see a sign of them. They just flattened out in sagebrush. The sagebrush gets 6 feet tall. A lot of persons are not aware of that, but even mule deer can hide in sagebrush or stand still. They can't see them. So they can flatten out in these little small turfs of the Nevada desert out there, which people call boring. For me, it's exciting. But anyway, that's what they can hide in, just in nothing at all.
Well, I mean, maybe there was some caves there with small...
Yeah, or a little dip in the ground or something.
Just almost anything.
A ditch. Yeah, you know, I don't know why people can't understand how easy it is to disappear. You're not looking for somebody or anything. You're not going to see one. And that's...
Don, the greatest gift that God ever gave man was an open mind, or the ability to open his mind and to think in the abstract, because oftentimes the solution to problems are abstract. They're not what you think or consider to be a normal solution. So
that's why critics are so important. If critics are really intelligent, they might find an answer that the so-called pseudo-know-it-all that have no idea about. Critics sometimes are very important. Right? Intelligent critics are welcome in my area, but the ones who are not...
Criticism is part of problem solving. You know, there's no question.
Yeah,
about
it sure is.
But you know, you if you're a flaming critic, what you do is shut doors. You know, you drop cages. You you bar yourself and others, you know, from like the Smithsonian here. They didn't publish this. Maybe somebody knew something about these people. Maybe somebody could have said something. Somebody that lived in the area or came in there a little bit later or something. But these pictures were not available, so no, it didn't stimulate any conversation. It didn't. No exchanges took place. No scientific meetings. No anything. Until
well, just think of this right now. In the last 5 years of my life, I've had things discovered we can't even talk about because they don't want to hear it, because they don't want to get it out, because it's going to put stopples on house sales, land sales. They don't want the people to know about certain things out there because it's going to stop the Anyway,
well,
it's terrible. What
yeah, I guess so.
And in Hawaii, there's places I've been up there on Beachcombs, and I did it 2004 and 5 down there on the Big Island. And there's areas that are large. I mean, let's go 20 miles, and Kamehameha Trail, where they got bone people buried in Calabash. And if there's one bone found in the next 2-3 miles, no one can ever buy that property or settle it. So, it's a burial ground. And so this is what we got facing today. People don't realize what's been covered up because they don't want people knowing that there's things out there they could identify. Real estate is a big story, in this country.
Well, I'm sure in that and other pursuits as well, we search for our past, but I don't really know if we really search for it in any kind of way, that's productive. The Smithsonian, Mr. Herliska, went up to the Aleutian Islands with bulldozers and dozed all those people's graves up. He got ancient bones, but he also got modern bones, and he also bought corpses of people who had just recently died and took them back to
the a monster, a human monster, what he was.
Right. It's like, come to my lab and see what's on my slab, And they strip these corpses of flesh and they mounted the bones or either stored them away. I think they had in the neighborhood of 18,000 Native Americans. What are you looking for there? Why would you take this many people out of their graves? Against their
will? Well, am I wrong? And I've read about him too, and I think he didn't think that the Native Americans and other type of ethnic peoples were even human. To him, they were all subhuman. They were all something they didn't want to identify with being equal to him.
Yeah.
He was another Hitler, my kind of a thinker, what I mean?
Well, he was a eugenicist. His idea was that there was a lesser and greater races, and you can tell a person's intellectual potential by the shape of their heads. And he was the advisor to the United States on the merit of preserving Indian culture, so it's easy to see why we don't have anything now, hardly. Why the Indians and Native Americans and First Peoples, were, depending on where you're at, were treated so badly. If you're going to take over a continent, you can do it in a more graceful way. You don't have to completely...
It's interesting about Australia. I was down there in 2006 doing some research. Anyway, down there, there's more interest in the Yowie. I mean, it's 10 times the interest and the enthusiasm we find in the United States on the Sasquatch. I mean, people there are absolutely looking and helping to find you evidence that they can put their finger on, And what's amazing about the whole thing is the paradox of the Aborigines down there, they call them. The ones down there, and how they killed them all off, and yet they still lean toward their culture and philosophy even today somewhat, refer to a lot now, and they revere it as something to look at now, and more than we do here. We take the Native Americans here for granted a whole bunch, and we shouldn't.
Well, we put them in impossible situations, Don, and as generations go by, they don't know their past as well as they should, because...
That's true.
Pretty much strip them, of their culture, and in a short period of time, when you're not exposed to what your forefathers and your
Okay, do you have any casts here showing the buttocks area that I photographed?
No, Don, I couldn't find that one, so I'll have to look for it.
Oh, that's so important to me.
Put it up
I might just tell them about it a little bit. I've got pictures, and they're on film, and I've got them right here in my library. But, you know, they've never been seen. But they show the posterior, the buttocks of the creature, humanoid, you know, wherever they're sitting down, in this soft stuff, and absolutely you can see the hair follicles. Now, that's pretty hard to get that. And I've got, it shows the hair follicles and the separation between them, and it's not that thick, actually. It's sparse in some respects, but it's thicker than, well, I don't know what to compare it to, but, I mean, it's not there in large numbers, as you would think, according to prototype. Even Patty didn't have as much hair on her as I think you think she did. If you get down to film takes and everything and break them down. But anyway, so that's important to me. But her posterior, in this picture I had with me at the time Lewis Chandler, and I think I had a couple other guys with me at the same time. We had three of us in the cave. I had them plumped down in the same position in the same way after we got the pictures taken on the cat, on the same thing we just took pictures of, and they plopped down against a rock, back to the rock, and it was just as comfortable as could be. And they said, absolutely, the person sat here, just like we did.
Oh,
and
so,
then, you
so
know, we've had fun with this.
You kind of reenacted it?
Yeah, and I did it more than once on more than one cast, and see the angle they stood, what is there, why did it pick that spot, and so on. And it's obvious. I mean, of course, it's, unless you're there yourself, Don's full of BS, you know? But, I mean, you've got to be there. And so it's hard to take a picture even. They say, well, you got photography nowadays, they can trick everybody. Hey, I can't. I don't know a thing about pictures very much.
No. I take a lot of pictures. Taking a picture in a cave is one of the hardest things you might ever do.
It's difficult.
If you use a flash, it's going to bounce all the way around 360.
That's right. I found the most subdued pictures I've taken been lucky with little cheap cameras, the ones you buy for throwaway kind of cameras. And I use candlelight, and I don't get too much light on it. I've had a lot of good luck for being a real novice about it. I really have. And because of our funding, too, we have no money supporting my efforts. We're totally self-sufficient. It's difficult to even get enough gas to get there sometimes. But anyway, the thing is, it's been rewarding because the cameras I've used and my experience to bring nil, but it's amazing what's come up. It really is amazing. It really is amazing.
Well, I tell you what, I'm very impressed with the detail that's in the casting, Don. It's not, I haven't really seen that kind of detail in any other casts of any type, you know, where that level of interest.
I just might add here that nobody wants to see what I have. I don't care. I'm burned out. I've about had it, and I don't even want to worry about that anymore. I'm just getting to the point where
I mean,
I'm getting there. I'm getting there.
Goes
down, my whole life,
around, you know that.
But it's discouraging to go out there, and I won't bump heads and go out there and say, look at this and all that kind of stuff. I don't give a darn. But the thing is, somebody should care. I'm going to die a few more years. I mean, I'm at 100. And I'm going to write, if I can, a paper. And after I'm dead, have it printed, because there's some things I could tell you that I really believe I know that might be discovered in another generation. But nobody in this one wants to hear it because they got a prototype attitude toward what they can allow to be the thing that they allow to be Sasquatch or Bigfoot or whatever you want to call it. And there's more than one thing possible.
Well, sure it is. Like I said, the open mind is the main thing. Yeah, you have to look at the evidence. I mean, you don't accept things pell-mell. But the reason why I have these things posted up here tonight, Don, is because of the significance that the evidence seems to come from more than one source. So
how many pictures you have posted there, MK?
No, it's just 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 pictures, but they all complement each other. You know, you can see the long fingerprints in the Utah cave.
Well, get back that bandaged hand. That's so important to me because
the guy with the bandages on his legs and feet that are almost identical looking to the bandages that you casted in this cave.
If you can grasp this now, what did they use to bandage themselves with? Well, in some of my cave areas, it's within 10 miles or less. There's sometimes dumps where primitive dumps out there. And in my kind of country, people dump their trash. It's free. They don't have to get a trash bill. So there are a lot of things dumped out there. Well, did they tear that part of T-shirt? Did they get an old pair of jeans? What did they use? It looks like pieces of sweater to me. It looked like pieces of sweater.
Well, whatever
well,
it is.
I don't know, Don. I'm looking at it, and I really can't tell for sure.
It's not gauze. It's not gauze as we know it.
Maybe could it be just strips of like maybe skin or leather or
a T-shirt?
I don't know.
I got to add that in there because we have nowadays. There's people toss out trash everywhere they go, and there's always a shirt laying somewhere if you look hard enough. Like I pointed out before, these modern wild men have no use to map arrowheads. They can find glass anywhere they go, already broken.
Well, you know, Ishii quit using rocks and flint and obsidian whenever the people moved into the valley along Mill Creek, and they started discarding bottles. He started making 100% of his arrowheads out of bottle. He said he can make one quicker and better out of a bottle than he could out of, you know, just minerals. So, you know, that's what you call adaptation, you know.
Well, if you want to know about that real quickly, I'll tell you a little experiment. I did it about a year ago down in Arizona. I was camped out for a while out there, and I made a bow and arrow. Anyway, so I got a bottles of water, glass bottle full of water, and corked the top of them. And then you shatter them on a rock carefully, get back, and they'll shatter in long negation of pieces of glass broken, opposed to the just shattered glass you ordinarily see. And I could almost pick out, I did do it. I picked out the arrowhead pieces out of there that were already made and then put them into my shafts, and I made some arrows and went out there, and I had a lot of fun with it. And I could see where I just trying to emulate Ishii and other people, wild man. And the arrows would shoot very straight, and, you know, and I could see where with little knowledge that I have, I could do it, and with a little expertise, and, you know. And I used, in this case, and this no kidding, I used what you call dental floss to wrap my arrowheads in there, and it was simple to do. And I even used some duct tape on one of them. And I even took some razor blades and broke them in half that I shaved with and put the parts on an angle. You can do all kind of things without napping arrowheads, I'm trying to say. You don't have to leave evidence of yourself out there in the society. Some of these people before, a Bigfoot would have said, well, they don't leave enough evidence to prove that they're human. To me, they have no evidence proves they are here, human, because they don't.
Yeah, we're backwards that way. Do we have any emailers? Anybody emailed Scott?
Let me check. I'll be right back with you.
Okay.
Any questions from last week's show, MK? I wonder.
Yeah, he's gonna go look.
Yeah, give me a second. We're having a very slow running PC at the moment. I'll get back in about 1 minute.
All right.
But people, I want you to know that I don't know it all. And I sound like I might. I don't. I'm learning all the time, and we the people who are serious are. We don't have founded, conclusive statements to make that people will live with. You might have a feeling that it's your theory, it's your lifeblood, but you can't say there's nothing to research unless you have something to compare to it. But there are some anomalies that are very strange out there, and some very, very interesting things that's happening. People overlook all the time.
Yeah, that's right. You know, one thing I can say is that no matter what you may think, no matter what you may, have developed in the way of theories, always be prepared to change directions in midstream. You know, if you have to, if the facts say, you know, that you need to, if you are a seeker of the truth, it's the facts. What we're searching for is. The facts about something that has very scant evidence. So
when you ask the question to yourself why you're doing this kind of thing, whoever you are, in my case, the whole person I can answer for, I have seen these creatures, and so I have on three occasions, absolutely, and I've been near them four other times, and because of that fact, it's beyond exhilaration. It's just something that I don't know. It's more than a hobby. It's your lifeblood almost. Adventure to me is. That's all I care about. That's all I got left.
Well, I'll tell you what. I don't know if I would get exhilaration if I was in the cave with these two guys and they were,
remember Tanya? She died.
Walking around behind the rocks.
Tanya died last September. I took her in the caves last year, and she was afraid to go in there. But she wrote in her journal, I just found it, and she says, I can't believe, and she said she can't stay away now. Well, she's still frightened to death, but, you know, the shadows on the wall, the flicker of the candle, the knowledge of a creature just left the cave with four legs, a bobcat, but whatever it is, it's in your latent humanity, you know, the adventure of everything out there, if you are that kind of person with the mindset for that, It's exhilarating. It's just beyond description. I don't know how to put it in words either. But,
well, if you're writing a book, try it.
Well, I'm doing it right now, but I don't know how. I've got four of them going. Better get them done or not. I almost got a couple of them. But now it's on the horses mostly. I'm doing a horse book. It is incredible on the moon phase.
Yeah, well,
going.
You're talking about the braided horse manes?
Oh, yeah. I don't have 3 months. I've got December, January, and February now on the moon phase. It's happening exactly what I predicted in the same way it is. I found a marvelous picture I took of Neil Hink about 2007 or 8, and I didn't know I had it. He's holding a plated braid, you know, of the horse on his hand, of his own horses, about a yard long. And Neil was one of the foremost trainers in the world. His horses are what I was studying for a long time. And I'm going down next week in the southern Idaho. It's 500 miles from where I'll be in Utah for the Vets Hospital. But I'm going down to see that horse that's been transferred down there to be trained. It's been plated, it's been braided 3 times in the last 3 months in the same moon face. And that's a long story short, but there's a lot going on out here in that horse braiding going on. It's getting more interest all the time because it's happening everywhere. It seems like there's a lot of it going on around the world. And it's not one person going out there messing around. That's ridiculous. We're not pixies and fairies or goblins, you know what I mean? That's ridiculous stuff.
Well, gentlemen, I'm sorry it took me so long. Our PC here at email PC was just... had to be rebooted. We've only got time, actually, for one email that's come in because there are more emails. We'll have to pick them up next month. But we are almost at the top of the hour. So real quick, let's get this one in from DR, and it says, Don, where would Bigfoot get cloth to make bandages?
Easy to answer. Within the 6 miles from Zakonoris Cave, where I found this evidence, was the dump. And this dump has been there before I was even in the area. I was there 16 years once. But the thing is, it was a dump by the community. And in that dump was things like overshoes, jackets, coats, T-shirts. Who knows what they threw away. Pieces of canvas. I mean, there's any number of things. And there's more story here if I had time to tell you. But that's where it comes from. Dumps, perhaps, or alongside the road. Someone tosses out a shirt. Who knows what. But I think there were pieces myself of my indications of wrapped up pieces like T-shirt or maybe a... like a sweater, you know, like a cotton sweater or something. But they wrapped. Well, this shows absolute human effort. And in my estimation, somebody helps somebody else too, so it's a joint effort. And that's more than amazing to me, because it's hard to wrap yourself properly. You can. But then tie it off at the end. It takes somebody else to tie it off, usually. So, yeah, that's what it is. It comes from some kind of degree.
That answers it, then. It's available. So,
it is. I can go out there in 15 minutes in any area where people live or have been there and run around beaches area too. And you can find shower shoes. You can find toothbrushes. You can find anything
that's
humanity
right.
has tossed out sooner or later.
That's right. Men are the human race are pigs. We leave stuff all over the planet. I suppose
they
that
do.
Would be pretty easy to find the way we just litter all over
Hobo's
the planet.
Yeah, I got a rest stop. You know, what is this, you know?
Well, guys, we are right up against the clock. It's news time from CBS is sitting right there. I got to fly. Guys, thank you so much for another interesting program, and I'd like to let everybody know this broadcast is now averaging 130,000 listeners per show. You guys are kicking butt. Thanks for all that you guys do.
Well, find a book.
I got one coming out.
All right, we'll see you next month, everybody. CBS News, Project Your Ranch, and the Artie Kornfeld Show are all live, and they're coming your way in about 5 seconds. You're listening to the Artist First Radio Network.